Morning, everyone. Today's daf in the Dharma is Pei Hei. We start today on Pei Dal in the base. We're going to start today to two dots. We're in the 11th parak of Nedarim. We're discussing those Nedarim that the husband can be made for on his wife. Wife makes a neder. The husband has a right after having heard the neder to annul the neder. That's been the topic of discussion over the course of the 9th, 10th, and 11th parakim of the Masechta. There are various parameters which we've been discussing over the course of this Masechta. And the 11th parak opened up with a very basic idea, and that is that the husband's right to annul his wife's neder does not apply to all nedarim, but rather only applies to nedarim that have inui nefesh, that afflict her. But if it's nedarim that she makes that doesn't afflict her, so then he can't be made for the neder. Although we did learn in the Gemara, inui nefesh isn't the only category that the husband can be made for. He can also annul the wife's nedarim if it is beino levena, if it affects their relationship, causes any type of animosity or acrimony within the relationship, so he can be made for those nedarim as well. But short of that, the main category that the Mishnah describes is what's called inui nefesh. Just an opportunity again to thank the Lubin Foundation for sponsorship of the Daf. Daf is on the Zechon Nishmas Liba Gavriela Bar Shmuel. So you take a look at the Mishnah, since the beginning of the 11th parak. So we discussed the Mishnah in terms of what are the general parameters of inui nefesh. So let's say the Mishnah says, this takes us to the Mishnah on Pei Gimel Amud Beis. So let's say she makes a neder and she says, that's it, I'm not going to get supported by anybody. So the Mishnah says, interestingly enough, that's not inui nefesh. So the husband does not have the right to revoke that neder because she can go and collect from Lekit Shechem Peah, meaning she can collect like poor person would collect, and so therefore that's not considered inui nefesh. It's certainly a strange idea, but in other words, there's still food for her to eat out there. And then the Mishnah goes on to discuss a very strange scenario in which she basically makes a neder that says, Kohanim and Levim are not going to get benefit from me, meaning that she has a certain amount of Trumas and Maisos, and she says to the Kohanim, to the entire mass of the Kohanim, all Kohanim, Einam Nanam Li. No one's going to be able to take my Truma. So what did the Mishnah say? So they say. So the Mishnah says the Kohanim come over to her house and say, you know, we heard that you prohibited your truma to all Kohanim. Okay, thank you very much. We'll come and we'll take our truma. You don't have the right to do that. Okay, and then the Mishnah goes on to describe another scenario, which is basically the same, but with one small difference, and that is the Mishnah says, what if she says, I'm going to prohibit my truma to not all the Kohanim, but only a limited number of Kohanim, and she actually identifies the Kohanim then that are not going to come and take her truma. Okay, that's obviously not nice of her, but on the other hand, however, the Torah gives her the right, or any owner of Trumas and Maisos, the right to determine who's going to be the recipient of Trumas and Maisos. In fact, Trumas and Maisos is predicated on the idea that it's not yours, meaning Trumas and Maisos don't belong to you, but you have the power of allocation. You can be the determinant of who's going to be the recipient of Trumas and Maisos. So the Mishnah says is that if she identifies which Kohanim, which Levim are going to be unable to accept it, so then the Mishnah goes on to say, and by the way, I'm sorry, and obviously we're discussing the Nedarim. This is not just a basic discussion of Trumas and Maisos. And she makes a neder. And she says that I'm making through a neder that this Kohen is not going to be the recipient of this Truma, of my Truma. Again, mine meaning I have the right to allocate who it goes to. So the Mishnah says, okay, so Kohanim Achirim, so other Kohanim are going to be able to come along and take the Truma. Fine. Which means that there's a Chalos Neder, meaning that there's going to be effectiveness to our Neder. Good. That's what we saw together at the Mishnah, and the Gemara is now going to be discussing, and the Gemara is bothered by the following. We have this general idea that when you have Trumas and Maisos, so you have the power of allocation. You can determine who is going to receive it. Okay, this is what's called Tovas Anah. Tovas Anah, a topic that comes up over time and again, and it's a great discussion in the Gemara because really what the Gemara is going to try to do is give a monetary value to Tovas Anah. I've given this analogy a number of times already. You ask any politician, meaning that the money that they, quote-unquote, have, they don't have money, but they have the power to allocate money. That's significant. That obviously has a value to it. Now, of course, some politicians go too far. They take bribes for the allocation of that money. So it clearly has a value to it. I'm not condoning, obviously, but just to understand that, you know, that power of allocation certainly has a value to it. The question on the table that we're going to ask today, we've asked this question, forms of this question earlier in Shas, and we ask it today, and that's the following. She has what's called this tovasana. She has the ability to allocate who's going to be recipient of the truma. Does that tovasana, does that allocation, does that have a, is that called mamon? Does that call a monetary value? So the Gemara says, well, if you look at our Mishnah, we gotta get conflicting messages in our Mishnah. And let's see the Gemara together inside. We're on Pei Dalam and Beis, where the two dots go on. Okay, Alma Tovasana in a Mammon. So you look at the first case in the Mishnah. What do you get? What idea do you get from the first case in the Mishnah? No, it's not Mammon. Why? Because in the first case in the Mishnah, she said to all the Kohanim, all the Levim, you're not getting my Truma. I have Truma, I have Meiser, meaning again, I have, meaning I have produce, and I segregated, I tithe Truma to Meisers. She said to the entire Kohanim community, none of you are getting it. So what did the Mishnah say? They can come over against their will and take it from her. So I'm sorry. And even though she made the statement by force of a neder, so her neder has no validity whatsoever. So the idea that you get from the Mishnah is that the reason why it has no validity whatsoever is because she has no monetary ownership over the Trumas HaMaisos. And not even the Tovasana, and not even her ability to allocate, has a monetary value to it. That's what it certainly sounds like from the first case of the Mishnah. But then the Gemara says, well, let's go on to the next case of the Mishnah. Kohanim Elu, Levim Elu, Nanim Li. If, however, she says that that particular Kohen and that particular Levi, by force of a neder, is not going to be able to take this Trumas HaMaisos, so Yilu Achirim. So the Mishnah says, okay, so they can't come and take this Trumas HaMaisos. Which means then that any other Kohen and any other Levi can come and can take it. Again, assuming that she is agreeable. Avalahani lo. But what do you see from this part of the Mishnah? That the Kohanim that she selected that cannot receive the Trumas HaMaisos, cannot receive it by force of a neder. Meaning, she is considered the quote-unquote owner of the Trumas HaMaisos, where she can affect a neder so that a particular Kohen can't take her Truma. So what does that tell you? That tells you that she does have quote-unquote ownership over the Trumas HaMaisos. Again, ownership in the sense of Tovah Sanah, and she could forbid it onto a particular Kohen. So the Gemara says, now I'm totally confused. Ama Tovah Sanah, Mamon. So now the Gemara says, we are in the world of confusion. Because when asked the question, you have Trumas HaMaisos to allocate to a Kohen and Levi. You have the ability to determine who it's going to go to. This is what's called Tovah Sanah. Question, does Tovah Sanah have a monetary value to it or does it not? Is it Mamon or is it not Mamon? In the first case of the Mishnah, it certainly sounds like it's not Mamon. Because she tried to oster the entire Kohen community from taking it. The Mishnah says, they come and take it. Sounds like it's not Mammon. Second case in the Mishnah, where she identifies particular Kohanim who can't take it, they can't take it because it's Mammon. And if they take it, it's going to be a violation of her neder. So when you look at the Mishnah, so you are confused. Now, intuitively, everyone here understand that there probably is a difference between forbidding all the Kohanim versus forbidding one or two, selecting certain Kohanim. So you can imagine that intuitively you already see a difference. But before we get to that, that's going to be the punchline of the entire discussion. What the Gemara is going to try to do is formulate that maybe this issue over here is a larger issue. Maybe it speaks to some basic issue. So this is what the Gemara is going to try to do now for the next couple of minutes, is try to set up this debate, this machlokas of the Gemara, as a general, larger issue. So the Gemara... Yeah, go ahead.
In the first case, isn't she totally relinquishing the Tovah Sanah? She's totally relinquishing the Tovah Sanah. So it's as if it's not even there.
Well, right, correct. In other words, again, you're speaking to the idea that there's got to be some difference between ostering all the Kohanim versus selecting another. Again, the Gemara is going to get there. That's the intuitive difference between the first and second case in the Mishnah, and the answer really lies in that difference. But right now, the Gemara is going to try to pass off that maybe the issue over here is an issue of Tovah Sanah. Or in other words, the Gemara is going to try other approaches, but then ultimately, Danny, the Gemara is going to come back to our approach, which is there's got to be some difference between the first and second case inherent in all the Kohanim versus some Kohanim. Okay, so, and we're going to get there. But meanwhile, the Gemara starts off like this. So the Gemara says, Amar Rav Oshia lo kasha harebi av Rav Yosef b'Rav Yehuda. So let's go now, attempt number one of the Gemara to try to give an explanation. This is Rav Oshia, and he says like this. Look, the debate over here really is predicated on another debate that takes place, and that is whether or not Tovah Sanah is a mammon or not a mammon. D'tanya, the Gemara says, look, consider the following. It's a b'raisa. And the b'raisa reads like this. Hagon of Tivlo shel Chaveiro. Okay, I have tevel, meaning in my house I have produce, which I just took from the, I just harvested. I went out into my field, harvested all my wheat, barley, right, grapes, olives. Just trying to keep it simple and trying to keep it that everyone agrees it's chayv and shumas and maisos. Good, so then I put it all in my silo and I haven't done anything yet. So that's what's called tevel, meaning I haven't taken off shumas and maisos. And what happens? The ganav comes over and he steals my tevel. Okay, not nice. And now he comes and he steals, and what happens afterwards? We take him to task, right? We catch the ganav and we say, look, you got to pay. Now it's interesting. Now the question, of course, is how much does he have to pay? And so that's exactly what the Brisa discusses. So the ganav took it and the ganav ate it. So now he doesn't have the original fruit. And now he's got to make compensation. And the question is a very simple one. How much compensation does he need to make? So, Rebbe's of the opinion, he's got to pay for all of it. Pay for all of it. He stole all of it, he's paid for all of it. Now, if you think about Rebbe for a moment and really consider, now this ganav, right, is not a nice guy and did the wrong thing, and okay, but he's ready to do tshuva, and he's ready to reimburse and compensate that which he stole. Great. To which the Gemara is bothered, I'm sorry. Which now Rebbe says, okay, so the ganav pays for everything. Think about it for just a moment. You think to yourself, why should he pay for everything? Meaning, this ganav, I understand that a good portion of it ultimately will be owned by the farmer, but not all of it. After all of Trumas and Maisers have been separated, the farmer is left with approximately 78%. Approximately. After taking off Truma, giving it to the Kohanim, after taking off Maiser Rishon, and then the next portion depends on the year of Maiser Ani, Maiser Sheni, or Maiser Ani. Okay, but anyway, let's keep the discussion simple. Okay, so at least for the first 12%, 2% going over to the Kohen, and 12% going over to the Levium. So at least for the first 12%, the farmer doesn't own that. That's going to go off to Kohanim and Levium. So this thief who stole, so granted that he ate all the tevel, but Rebbe's of the opinion that he should pay for everything, including the part that ultimately the farmer is going to have to give away, which means it doesn't really belong to the farmer, and yet according to Rebbe, he has to pay for everything, including future truma and future meiser. That's strange. That's a strange opinion. In fact, it's such a strange opinion that even the Ran himself says it's not exactly as simple as I just laid it out. That he has to pay for everything, because again, if you think about it, if you consider it, paying for everything, that means even the portion that's going to go away. So the Ran writes that what's meant over here is that the non-truma and the non-meister, meaning, again, just for simplicity's sake, let's just say 88%, even though that is a gross oversimplification. But let's say the 88%, for sure, the ganav has to pay for. And the 12%, the ganav doesn't have to pay for its full value, because, again, the farmer never is really going to own that. But what the ganav does have to pay for is tovas hanah. Again, there's some form of value based on the fact that you are going to allocate it to the Kohanim and Levim. You have the right to determine who's going to go to. So it's basically going to be a discounted value, but there is a value to it. Okay, hopefully that was clear. Either way, the point still being is that according to Rebbe, you have to pay for everything. The Ganav has to pay for everything, even for the Truma and Meiser. Divrei Rebbe, Rebbe Yosef, Rebbe Yehuda, Omer, Einu Mashalim, Elo Demei Chulin Shabbat. Rebbe Yehuda says, no, of course not. Ganav wants to do tshuva. The Ganav wants to pay for that which he stole. He only has to pay for the part that that's ultimately going to be owned by the farmer. The Truman Meiser, again, just for simplicity's sake, 12% of it is not going to stay with the farmer. So the Ganav doesn't have to pay for that 12%. Now, of course, right. In other words, there is a subsequent discussion of he did take away from the Levim and he did take away from the Kohanim. Okay, but I'm not looking to overlook that point. We're just discussing what kind of compensation he needs to make towards the farmer. So towards the farmer, so Rav Yehuda says, you only compensate the farmer that which the farmer was able to retain. Since the farmer was only able to retain 88% of it, so therefore, the thief who wants to do tshuva only has to pay for 88% of it, and he doesn't have to pay for the trumas and maaser. So, what do you see from this discussion of the thief stealing tevel, and how much is needed to compensate? So, the Gemara points out, what seems to be an issue over here My love, Hakamiflagi. So what's that issue over here? We're on the top of Pehemad Aleph. Is the Rebbe Savatovasana Mammon? Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda Savatovasana in a Mammon. The Gemara says this really cuts into the core of the discussion that we're having right now. Is that when Rebbe says that the Ganav has to pay for everything, including the Truma Meiser, farmer doesn't own Trumas and Meisers. So according to Rebbe, he does. He owns Trumas and Meisers. Again, owning meaning, obviously, he's going to give it to a Kohen. But because he can determine which coin he's going to give it to, that gives him quote unquote ownership of the Trumas and Maisos. Power of allocation is tantamount to ownership, and therefore if the thief comes and steals it, he has to pay for that as well. That's the opinion of Rebbe, as opposed to Rebbe Yosef, Rebbe Yehuda, who says no, Tova Sana is not considered Mammon, and therefore if the thief wants to pay back, he only has to pay back for the portion that's going to stay with the farmer, but not for Trumas and Maisos. So here it seems now that what we've laid out is a basic debate between Rebbe and Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Yehuda in terms of whether or not Tova Sana is considered Mammon or is not considered Mammon. And if that's true, so now what the Gemara is suggesting is maybe that's the two sides of our Mishnah. The first half of the Mishnah that says that if she asers her Trumas and Maisos to all the Kohanim, they can come and take it. So that means that she doesn't have ownership of that. All the Kohanim and Levim can come and take their Trumas and Maisos against her will. So that's going like Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda. Whereas the second case of the Mishnah where she can aser individual Kohanim, that's going like Rebbe, where she does own it, so to say. Again, ownership in the form of Tova Sana. So the Gemara says, I don't know if that really is going to work out. So the Gemara says, the Gemara says no. I don't really like that explanation, says the Gemara. The Gemara doesn't explain why it doesn't like that explanation. It seems to be a very plausible explanation, but apparently the Gemara has some sort of Masarla. The Gemara says maybe the Gemara just feels that this is the halachic, the halachic acceptable position, which is Tova Sana is not considered Mammon. No one's going to argue that. Just because you have the power to determine who's going to go to doesn't mean that you have a monetary ownership of it. You just simply get to say who it's going to go to. So the Gemara says, maybe over here, the debate between Rebbe and Rebbe Yosef and Rebbe Yehuda is the following. Look, Tevel, what is Tevel? Tevel is unrealized Trumas and Maisos. Not most of it. Most of it's going to stay by the farmer. But 2% to the Kohen, 10% to the Levi, that's unrealized Trumas and Maisos. And maybe what the Gemara is, maybe what's at the core of the discussion over here is as follows. It's unrealized right now. Trumas and Maisos have not been separated. Maybe what's at issue over here is, despite the fact that it hasn't been separated, maybe what's at issue over here is, do we view it as if it's already separated? So maybe that's at the core. The Ganav steals Tevel. So if we look at the unrealized Trumas and Maisos and simply say, it's not realized yet. It's still in the world of Tevel. It's something else. It's not Trumas. It's not Maisos. Even though the future, of course, in store is that we're going to take off Trumas and Maisos, but right now it's not. It's unrealized. So if we just simply view it as unrealized Trumas and Maisos, it's not Trumas and Maisos, it's just Tevel, so then the Ganav has to pay for everything. If, on the other hand, we look at the Tevel and say, look, we know what's going to happen, right? The story with Tevel ends up the same. 2% goes to the Truma, 2% goes to the Kohanim, 10% goes to Levim. So then, if we view it now, even though it's unrealized, but we know what's going to happen, so maybe then that would be the opinion of Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda, where he says that the thief wants to make compensation, he only needs to pay back the chulin, the non-truman meister portion of it. Okay, the Gemara says, fine. That's the way to explain the machlokis. The Gemara says, okay, and now, of course, once we're here, so then we're back to square one. The e tovas anayin amamon mali horma mali lo horma. So Elahinatama de Rebbe, so the Gemara says, okay, so if Tova Sana is not Mammon, so the Gemara says, so then whether it was separated or whether it wasn't separated, so the Gemara says, so then I'm not really following the whole discussion. Because even if we view it as unrealized Trumas and Maisos, but when all said and done, it doesn't have a monetary value, so what difference does it make? So the Gemara says, Elahainu time of the Rebbe, Kansur Rabban Laganav Kehechad Ola Lignav. So the Gemara says like this. Maybe the explanation of the Machlokas over here is really simple. Again, we're not discussing our Mishnah, we're going to get back to our Mishnah. We're discussing the Brice on the bottom of Pei Dalam and Beis. And maybe what's that issue over here is as follows. Look, Trumas HaMaisros do not belong to the farmer. When the Ganav stole it, even though right now it was unrealized Trumas HaMaisros, but when the Ganav stole it, he didn't steal from the farmer. But Rebbe says, okay, but he's a Ganav. And because he's a Ganav, and we don't want him to do that again, so according to Rebbe, you know what? You're going to pay the chulin, and you're going to pay for the Trumas HaMaisros. Ganav will say, yeah, look, I'm trying to be a better person. I want to pay back. I understand I have to pay back the chulin. I also have to pay back to the farmer, Trumas HaMaisros. He doesn't own it. He doesn't have considered ownership in it. To which Rebbe says, you're right. Part of the penalty of having stolen it is that you're going to have to pay back for all of it. It's a kanas.
But doesn't the farmer have to pay those when he gets it back?
The farmer is going to give it to the Kohen and Levi. No, the money he's going to receive. Oh, the money he's going to receive. Oh, that's interesting. I don't know. But in other words, but right now from the perspective of the Ganav is going to have to pay the farmer that money as a kanas, just simply as a penalty. Rav Yosef, Rav Yehuda, Sever, Kansur, Rabban, Labal, Abayis, Ki Hechid, Lalisha, Lativle. And according to Rav Yosef, Rav Yehuda, Rav Yosef, Rav Yehuda says, look, the Ganav obviously did wrong. The Baal HaBayis, on the other hand, we don't want him to gain from this experience, even though it's not a pleasant experience to have your food stolen, but the Ganav is going to come and pay you back. But the Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yehuda says, but look, but on the other hand, we don't want the owner of the field to quote-unquote gain from this whole experience, even though it wasn't a pleasant experience to begin with. And the reason why is because there never wants to be any type of incentive of, you know what, don't take off Trumas HaMaisros. Right? If there's any gain whatsoever of not taking off Trumas HaMaisros, that's a bad thing. Because what the farmer's going to do is, you know, in the event that it gets stolen, you know, I get compensated for everything. Why don't I just leave it like that? Well, I'll just leave it as tevel. So the Chachamim, any time they see that there was any type of incentive of a farmer not taking off Trumas HaMaisros, they take away that incentive. So that in the event that his tevel is stolen, so therefore he's only going to get compensated for the portion that was anyway going to be retained by him. Okay, so so what we have done now successfully is explain the machlokas in the brisa of the thief who steals tevel. Machlokas between Rebbe and Rebbe Yosef, Rebbe Yehuda, whether the thief has to make full compensation, even the Trumas HaMaisros that are going to be given away. According to Rebbe Yosef, Rebbe Yehuda, the thief only has to make compensation for the portion that's going to stay by the farmer, not for the Trumas HaMaisros. And what the Gemara said is that the discussion over here has nothing to do with whether Tovas Hanah is considered Mammon or it's not considered Mammon. And it's a whole different issue. It's a question of who are we ready to penalize? Are we ready to penalize the thief and therefore have him pay back everything? Or it's not really a penalty to the farmer, it's just let's not incentivize the farmer for delaying and taking off Trumas HaMaisros. So it's really a whole different issue altogether, and then that comes around now to our question which we asked at the beginning of this year today, which demands an answer. If that's true, what's the difference between the first case of the Mishnah and the second case of the Mishnah? The Mishnah presents itself on Pei Gimel Amud Beis. The Mishnah describes two scenarios, one where a woman by Konam says that the all Kohanim can't eat her Trumas HaMaisros. Mishnah says Kohanim come over, help themselves to Trumas HaMaisros. And in the second case of the Mishnah, she identifies particular Kohanim so they can't come and take the Trumas HaMaisros, other Kohanim can. What's the difference between the Reish and the Seifa? So Rava Amar Shani Truma Dehainu Tama Diitlu Akarcha Mishum De Truma Lo Chazia Ella Lo Kohanim Vekevin De Ka'asi Le Misra Elayu Shavya Afra Ba'alma. So the Gemara gives an explanation of Rava, and again, as I mentioned in the beginning, this really speaks to the intuitive nature of the difference between the first case of the Mishnah and the second case of the Mishnah. In the first case of the Mishnah, she takes her Kohanim and she says, this by neder, by force of a neder, all Kohanim cannot eat this Truma. Now, if all Kohanim cannot eat this Truma, so now what's going to become of this Truma? Well, if the Kohanim are not going to eat it, then no one's going to eat it, because no one else can eat it. So basically what she did is, All the people who could eat, who are candidates to eat this food, are no longer able to eat this food. And therefore, basically, what now happens is, Rava's language is, just read the language again, since she's prohibiting it to the people who can eat it, meaning all the Kohanim, Shavya Afra Ba'ama. She basically turns the Truma into Afra. It's now absolutely worthless. If nobody can eat it, it has no value to it, right? In other words, if something becomes prohibited to everybody, So therefore, what kind of value does it have? Value is generally spoken in terms of its utility. Its utility. If something doesn't have utility, therefore it doesn't have value. Okay? And so what Rava says is, that's the difference between the Reisha and the Seifa. In the Reisha, what she basically did by saying all Kohanim can't eat the Truma, is she has reduced the value of the Truma to zero. If she's reduced the value of the Truma to zero, now a Kohen can come over and say, look, I'll help myself to that. Oh, but she made a neder. Any Kohen who touches this is going to be in violation of my neder. No. Because she offered it to all the Kohanim, she's taken the item and made its value now zero. And so therefore, there's only a violation of a neder if somebody takes money. But here, because she offered it to all the Kohanim, therefore it no longer has a value. As opposed to where she says, this Kohen and that Kohen can't eat it, all the other Kohanim, please help yourself. She has not removed its value, because to a good number of the Kohanim out there in the world, it still is something that they can eat, and therefore the Kohanim that she specified who are not allowed to take it are in fact not allowed to take it. Period. Adkan divrei Rava. That's Rava's explanation, the difference between the Reisha and the Seifa of the Mishnah. Okay, if time permits later on, we're going to go through the Ran, because basically what sounds like from the Gemara is that once a food item loses its utility, it therefore loses its value. Meaning, if it's usher to the world, therefore it is no longer owned by the person. Okay? Speaks to the basic idea, which comes up a number of times throughout the Gemara, and that is, if something's usher behana'a, if I can't benefit from something, so therefore I no longer consider myself to be the owner of that item. Right? What's a prime example of that? Chametz on Pesach. Right? Chametz on Pesach, what happens? Is that I'm not allowed to eat the food, not only am I not allowed to eat the chametz on Pesach, I'm not allowed to get benefit from it. So then what should happen subsequently? I'm no longer considered the owner. But that's, of course, a little bit strange, because the Torah says one of the prohibitions of chametz on Pesach is you're not allowed to own it. So the Gemara Pesachim addresses that, and the Gemara Pesachim says, well, the Torah puts it in your possession even though it doesn't really belong to you. So again, this touches on the general issue of when something is prohibited to you, so can you now no longer consider to be the owner of it? Our Gemara certainly speaks to the idea of, that's correct, that's absolutely right. Okay. Start the next Mishnah. The next Mishnah is going to, again, touch on this basic question that we've been discussing since the beginning of the parak, and that is, what's considered inui nefesh? Okay? Inui nefesh, or the other category that we discussed in the Mishnah, is dvarim shebeino leveino. So, which the husband has the right to annul his wife's nedarim. So, konu she'ini ose al pi abba, ve'al pi avicha. Let's say she makes a neder and she says, look, right, for whatever reason, obviously all nedarim are rooted in the idea that something's gone sour in the relationship, and she says, I'm not providing for my father anymore. Anything I make, anything I produce with my hands is going to be prohibited to my father. Okay, she has, unfortunately, a poor relationship with her father. Or, she turns to her husband and she says, or anything I make is going to be prohibited to your father. Al pi achi, al pi achicha, or something will be prohibited to my brother, something will be prohibited to your brother. Eino yachol lahafir. So the Mishnah says the husband does not have the ability to be made for that neder. Why? Because it doesn't directly affect their relationship. Now, yes, right, you can make a very simple argument. It doesn't directly affect the relationship, but obviously it will add a little bit of animosity into their lives as, right, he wants to invite his father-in-law over, he can't. The wife made a neder. He wants to invite his own father over the house, he can't, because she made a neder. So, yeah.
Is the book Yared we're talking about?
Yeah, no, we're talking about a woman's married. She's married to a man. And
this is not Nisuin, but
the husband right now is the sole quote unquote owner of the neder, and he has the right to be made for his wife's neder. But again, he's limited to two categories. The only nedarim that he can be made for is either inui nefesh, if it's a neder that afflicts her, or if it's devarim shebeino leveino, things that affect their relationship. And what the Mishnah is introducing us to is the idea that this doesn't directly affect their relationship. Yes, it's going to indirectly affect the relationship, but that's not good enough. That does not give him the right to be made for the neder. That's what the Mishnah is teaching us. Therefore, eni yochel hafer. Okay. She'eni oseh al picha ain't a tzarech lahafir. Then the Mishnah goes on to discuss the following. Let's say the wife turns to the husband and says, ain't yos al picha. Right? Anything I produce, you're not going to get benefit from. So, ain't a tzarech lahafir. So the husband doesn't even need to be made for such a neder. Because the neder from the very inception simply never took effect.
It's his, right?
It's his.
Right.
Rabbi Akiva Omer Yafir Shematadi Falav Yosef and Aroilo. Rabbi Akiva says, look, there is a set amount that the wife is obligated to produce, and that production goes to the husband. And remember, this takes us back to the world of Ksuvos. Good. Right, the Gemara in Ksuvos, in the Nuns, if I remember correctly, hopefully I do, end of the Mems. End of the Mems, beginning of the Nuns. Anyway, the Gemara in the Ksuvah there says that involved in every marriage are basic institutions by the Chachamim of reciprocity between the husband and wife, so that they'll live happily ever after. And in the world of reciprocity, so the husband is obligated to support his wife, and in exchange for that, the wife produces Maisei Yadayim, and that production goes to the husband. But Maasei Yadayim, however, is not an infinite whatever she makes. Maasei Yadayim is just simply a set amount. The Gemara in Ksuvos gave us that set amount, and please don't ask me because I don't remember exactly what the set amount was. But anyway, but it's a set amount that the wife produces, and that set amount goes to the husband. So what Rabbi Akiva says is, look, she makes an edit and she says, my production is not going to go to my husband. Okay? So Rabbi Akiva says, look, on that, she's not even the owner of that. And because she's not the owner of that, so therefore the husband doesn't even need to respond to that. But there may be adafa, there may be additional, meaning she may have a very successful week in which she's going to produce above and beyond that which she's required to give to her husband. That is hers, and that will then become also to her husband, that the husband should respond to, and therefore Rabbi Akiva says that the husband should annul the neder, because in the event that she makes an additional over and above that which she over and above that which needs to go to the husband, so that may exist, and therefore he should have to be made for that. And then the third opinion, the Mishnah of Yochanan Nuri Omer Yafir Shem Yigarshenu V'ti Asur Alav. And then the Mishnah, we have the third opinion, that of Rav Yochanan Nuri, who says Yafer, who says that the husband should annul such an neder, because in the event Shema Yagashenu, that maybe he may divorce her, and then in the future if he divorces her, then the neder will in fact take effect. Now, Amar Shmuel. Okay. Before we start with the Gemara, let's go right into the Gemara. So the Amar Shmuel. Okay. So Halachik Rav Yochanan Nuri. Okay. So we have three opinions within our Mishnah. In terms of, in the first case of the Mishnah, the Gemara doesn't comment whatsoever. Meaning, again, what we learned in the first case of the Mishnah is that if the neder that she says does not directly impact the relationship between her and her husband, so then that doesn't fall under the category of Dvarim Shebeino Levina, and therefore it's outside of the purview of the husband. Husband cannot annul such a neder. Fine. Gemara leaves that undisturbed. Fine. The next point in the Mishnah, however, the Gemara is going to comment on, because there are three opinions in the Mishnah. If a wife says that her Maisei Yadayim are going to be asur to her husband, so Tanakama's opinion is, in a tzarech lahafir, husband doesn't need to respond. Rabbi Kiva's opinion is that the husband does need to respond because there may be hadafa. And Rabbi Yochanan Nuri says the husband should annul the neder in the event that they may get divorced. And if we forecast into the future, we don't want to see this happen, but if in the event that they get a divorce, so then all those items will become prohibited to him. So therefore, best that he annul it now, so we never get to that point.
She wouldn't be working for the husband after divorce.
So Amar Shmuel, just give me a moment. Perfect. Amar Shmuel, Halach Rav Yochanan Nuri. So Shmuel's of the opinion that the Halach of Halach Rav Yochanan Nuri. Okay. And then the only thing, therefore, to take into consideration is what's going to happen in the future.
Is Rabbi Yochanan Nuri said that he should annul it on a kind of inui?
No. This is not This does not fall under the category of inui. This falls under the category of dvarim shebeino levina.
So, based on that, if he divorces and annuls her now, why wouldn't the annulment be null and void after they're divorced?
Just give me 1 second. Now, what exactly is Rav Yochanan ben Nuri's opinion? Meaning, Rav Yochanan ben Nuri says, we're going to need to worry about what's going to happen in the future. So, the Gemara itself comments, but before we get to the Gemara's comment, let's just take a look at the Ran on the next Amud. Really, the Ran is commenting back on the Mishnah, but now let's spell out the opinion of Rav Yochanan ben Nuri even clearer. Take a look at the Ryan inside on Peheim and Bez, Rav Yochanan ben Nuri, Omer Yafir Shami Garshen, Vitehasir Lachzalo, Tisfir Lele Rav Yochanan ben Nuri, Kitanakama, Dafi Nami Labal, Havya. Okay, so first of all, the Ryan points out that what about Rabbi Akiva's concern that she may make more than the requirement? So the Ryan points out, that's fine. Rav Yochanan ben Nuri obviously sides with the opinion of the Tanakama, meaning the Tanakama also wasn't worried about the extra. Reason is because the Tanakhama, together with Rav Yochanan ben Nuri, are of the opinion that even if she makes above and beyond, that's also quote unquote owned by the husband as well. Mishum da'adaf ein tzarich la'afir ala shema yigarshenu v'yaneh d'chal shemishigarsha ein meshubed eslo lamasi adana. In the event that in the future, if they God forbid, they get a divorce, so now all the production that she makes is no longer quote unquote owned by the husband. He doesn't know. He no longer has a shibud on that production, and therefore it's going to be prohibited v'tehei asur alach zor lo lefi shenasa b'masi adah v'i efshar lo liizar shelo tita chen v'shol teafeh v'chol shar malachos hashnuz b'mishnasenu she'isha osel ba'alam. Okay, and now the Ran points out, Danny, this addresses your issue, and so after they get a divorce, okay, so let the neder be chal. The problem, says Ran, is the following. Let's say after the divorce, he now then reconsiders. And he says, you know, shame. Shouldn't have divorced her. It was really a mistake. I'd like to marry her again. Here's the problem. Problem is that after they get a divorce, so then her neder now is going to take effect. That means that all the production that she makes from this point going forward is going to be prohibited to that man. Now, that man was her husband, but now it's the ex-husband. Now, if the husband decides, yeah, but I'd like to marry her again, well, now they're going to have to live one of the most tenuous relationships ever, where that now anything she produces is going to be also to him via neder. Now, again, she can go to a chacham, she can be relieved from that neder. But that is... So Rav Yochanan ben Nuri says, I it's so unlikely, but... In the event that they get a divorce and he decides, you know, let's try it again, and he wants to remarry her again, he won't be able to because of the neder. That's the thought process behind Rav Yochanan Nuri. The Tanakhama Palagalad Rav Yochanan Nuri. Now, the Tanakhama disagrees with Rav Yochanan Nuri, and the Ran just spells out why should that be. So, imishum de lo sphere lay de mahanya afara lechime garishla, imishum de neder gufa kevin de hashalo chai lakame, nami lo chai, plugtai ba adafa. So, The Ran suggests a couple suggestions in terms of why the Tanakhama disagrees. Either, number one, because once the husband no longer needs to respond to this neder, the neder never takes effect altogether. Or because let's just leave it at that. In other words, it could very well be that the Tanakhama just simply says that the neder will never take effect. Okay, either way. What comes out now is the following, and it's a little bit strange, and the Gemara comments on that, and that is the following. Shmuel just told us the halacha falls like Rav Yochanan ben Nuri. The husband should have known this neder of the wife, because even though in its current state, the neder doesn't have any, is not binding, but in the future, it may be binding. And basically now, what Shmuel's basically telling us is that even though there's no existence of the neder now, but in the event that it will may happen, so therefore you should be made for the neder. This is what's called a davar shelo bala olam. And the Gemara says, where does Shmuel stand on this issue of davar shelo bala olam? So the Gemara says, lamayim edekas davar shmuel adam mekadesh davar shelo bala olam. Sounds like now you can make a neder that doesn't have application right now, but will apply to a future event. The Gemara says, v'riminu. The Gemara says, but let's consider the following. Hamakdish masa yidei ishta. So, let's say a husband goes over to his wife and he says, you know, any production that you make is going to belong to Hekdesh. Okay, strange scenario. What's going on over here? So once again, we remind ourselves of the Gemara we learned back in Ksuvos. Let's take a look at the Ran. Ran is the second medium line on the page. Hamakdish Masi the Ishtar is a Osev Ochelas. Ikadamukmala beperikaf api. So the Ron reminds us of the Gemara Ksuvas, and what did we learn back then? Afilo b'malala mezonos v'afilo hachi arishus biyad levatel hegdesho v'areze osev ocheles midrav huna da'amar ha'asam yichol isha lama labala inu nezonos v'ine osa. Okay, so number one, the opinion of Rav Huna, which the Iran reminds us of, and the opinion of Rav Huna is the following, that a wife is supported by the husband, but that is not an absolute. A wife can at any point in time say, look, the only reason why you're supporting me is because my masi adayim go to you, my production go to you, my earnings go to you. She could simply say at any point in time in the marriage that, you know what, I'm doing pretty well. Right, I'm earning well. You keep your mizonos, I'll keep my masi adayim. Okay, so she the Ron says, if you don't agree with Rav Huna, so why isn't the husband supporting his wife? So the Gemara in Ksuva says that maybe the husband just simply doesn't have the means of supporting his wife. Either way, a husband says that my wife's production is going to be hektish, or is it osav ochelas? The hamosar. So the Gemara says that she'll go to work, she'll earn money, and obviously with her earnings, she'll eat. She needs to eat. The hamosar. But what if there's any additional above and beyond that which feeds her? Rabbi Meir Omer Hektish, Rabbi Yochanan San La Omer Chulin. So we have a debate in the Gemara over there in Ksuvos. What happens to any of the additional? So Rabbi Meir is of the opinion that it belongs to Hektish. Rabbi Yochanan Sandler says, no, it's Chulin. V'amar Shmuel, halacha ka Rabbi Yochanan Sandler. So, and Shmuel over there in the Gemara Ksuva says that the halacha falls like Rabbi Yochanan Sandler. Why?
Contradict.
Right. Because Shmuel is of the opinion that we're talking about something which is not yet here, something that which will be produced in the future. A person cannot declare something Hektish if it's not yet in existence in the world. A person cannot meet makdish, a person cannot sanctify a davar shelo bala olam. So what we're now left with is, we're somewhat in the crosshairs. Sounds like from our discussion over here, where Shmuel sides with Rav Yochanan ben Nuri in our Gemara, in our Mishnah, meaning that if a wife makes a neder, the husband should annul the neder, not because of its current effect, but because of its future effect, if in the event they get a divorce, which is not now, but in the future. And yet, Rav Yochanan ben Nuri says that the husband should annul. And Shmuel endorses the opinion of Rav Yochanan ben Nuri as the accepted halacha. And meanwhile, as it relates to the Gemara Ksuvos, where a wife is earning, and she's keeping her earnings, which she's perfectly entitled to do so, according to Rav Huna. And the husband's makdish that, so it doesn't affect her staple earning. But any addition that she makes, there's a machlokus, and Shmuel sides with the opinion of Rav Yochanan Sandler, different Rav Yochanan, who says that it's not going to affect it. Why? Because it's a future, and you cannot be makdish something that is not yet here in the world. It's something for the future. And so this is what's called a stira within the opinion of Shmuel. So the Gemara says...
But the thing is that there's a difference between the two.
Okay, good.
Because Masi Adav is something that's more certain to come about eventually, whereas there's a potential that she...
Okay, you're up to tomorrow's daf, which is good. So let's see how the Gemara first reacts to it. So Avam Shmuel Lachir Rav Yochanan Sanla Amalei Nada Makdish Davar Shelo Bala Olam V'chitem Aki Kamar Lachir Rav Yochanan Nuri Al Hadafu De Kamar. So the Gemara says, and maybe, well, the only thing that he was addressing is Rav Yochanan Nuri as it relates to the Adafa. So the Gemara, meaning not the base earnings, but anything above and beyond. So the Gemara says, Lema Lachir Rav Yochanan Nuri Ba'adafa. So the Gemara says, well, that would be very misleading. Why doesn't Rav Shmuel make the statement that the halacha falls on Rav Yochanan Nuri as it relates to the Adafa? Inami halachi Tanakama, or simply say the halacha is like the Tanakama. Inami halachi Rabbi Akiva, or say the halacha is like Rabbi Akiva. So the Gemara says, Ella Amar Rav Yosef, Shani Konamos. So the Gemara suggests as follows. Look, there are two discussions that we're trying to compare. Our discussion that we're having in the world of Nedarim and the Gemara Ksuvos regarding a man being makdish his wife's earnings. Now, it's not the same. This goes all the way back to day one of the Masechta when we started Nedarim. There are two types of nidarim: nidre yisr, nidre hektesh. Nidre yisr, that's our mesechta. Our mesechta is talking about when a person makes something an asr through a neder, via neder, as opposed to hektesh. Hektesh means that I am objectively making this the property of the Beis HaMikdash. So what Rav Yosef now is going to try to suggest is that we could strike the following difference. Shani Kona Masova Adam Asar Peros Chavero Alav Asar Nami Davish Alo Bala Olam Alav. Maybe we could suggest the following. There is more flexibility as it relates to a neder as opposed to hektesh. Because think about a neder. A neder is looser. I know it's funny, but it is. Meaning, in the world of neder, I can prohibit something that doesn't belong to me as long as I make it prohibited to me. Remember, we discussed this day one of the Masechta. In the world of Nedarim, I can make something I own prohibited to me. I can make something I own prohibited to somebody else. I can make somebody else's property prohibited to me. As long as either the property, my property or me as is part of the equation, I can create a neder. The only thing I can't do in the world of Nedarim is I can't make your property usher to you. That's the only thing I can't do. In the world of Hekdesh, I can only make something Hekdesh, meaning in terms of the Beis HaMikdash, only if I'm the owner of it. I can't declare somebody else's property Hekdesh. It just simply doesn't work. So you see that in the world of Nedarim, it's a little bit looser. The parameters of what I can do are a little more expanded. So what the Gemara now is suggesting is that really Shmuel holds that Ein Adam Davar Makdish Davar Shlo Balolam. If it's something that's going to take place in the future and it's not here currently in the present, I can't be Makdish it. Good, that's in the world of Hekdesh. In the world of Nedarim, since you see Neder is more flexible to begin with, so maybe Shmuel also is going to extend the parameters of Davar Shlo Balolam. So the Gemara says, look, in the world of the Darim, I'll explain to you where the flexibility extends. I can make other people's property prohibited to me because I can make my property prohibited to him. That's the definition of a neder. But davar shelo balolam, it doesn't exist yet. You know what that's like, says the Gemara? That's like trying to assert somebody else's property onto the other person. Meaning, it's not yet in the world. So the Gemara says, I'm not ready to accept this idea that just because we do extend the parameters of neder over that of hektesh, but it shouldn't affect davar shelo balolam. Davar shelo balolam is just simply not here yet. So the Gemara gives the answer of Rav Huna. Okay, we're going to see this answer of Rav Huna a couple of times. And that is that what the husband was declaring is not that the production is hektesh, but the hands are hektesh. Hands are not a davar shelo balolam. This answer we're going to explore a lot more tomorrow in tomorrow's daf, and we'll kind of shape that answer a little bit better tomorrow. Okay, let's just quickly recap, let's review, and we'll conclude for today. Half of today was dedicated to the Mishnah on Pei Gimel and Beis. The Mishnah made a distinction where a woman said, all Kohanim are prohibited by neder to eat my Truma Meiser. Again, my, with in quotes. My Truma Meiser, and the Mishnah says they come over, they take Truma Meiser, she can't do anything about it, as opposed to the second case of the Mishnah where she tells which Kohanim by Neder cannot eat Truma Meiser, and the Neder is Chal. What's the difference? Gemara's answer, Gemara tried a couple of answers, but the Gemara's ultimate answer is, when she says all Kohanim, basically she reduced her Truma Meiser to a value of zero. Once you make something prohibited to all of its consumers, therefore you take away its value now is zero, and because now the value of it is zero, so therefore any Kohen that comes and takes it is not going to be in violation of the Neder, because you only violate the Neder when you take something of monetary value. She's reduced the value to zero. Good. Next thing we discuss in the Mishnah is, we then moved on to the next Mishnah. A wife can make a neder affecting her father, her husband's father, her brother, her husband's brother. It's not considered varim shebein olavena. It doesn't directly affect the relationship. And then the Mishnah goes on to say, what about the husband, um, the um, her Maisei Adayim, she makes a neder about it. Does he need to respond to that neder of Maisei Adayim? Three-way machlokus in the Mishnah. Rav Yochanan Nuri says that he should be made for the neder because of the potential future result of them getting a divorce and then the neder taking chalos. Shmuel endorses that opinion of Rav Yochanan Nuri, which only begs the question: then what about the fact that it's a davar shel bala olam? The Gemara asks that question, and right now we're in the middle of Rav Huna's answer. Rav Huna's answer is: you are makdish the hands, not the production, and we'll talk more about that answer tomorrow.